Michael Gibney began working in restaurants when he was just 16, washing dishes at an Irish pub in Buffalo. He rose to a sous chef position at 22, and he's worked at Tavern on the Green, 10 Downing, Governor in Brooklyn, other well-known New York restaurants. And he's written a book, which is called Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line, which takes the reader into the kitchen of an upscale New York City restaurant on the day of a packed Friday night dinner service. It's published by Ballantine Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Michael Gibney to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
What's the role of a sous chef in the kitchen?
A sous chef is the second in command, sort of a lieutenant who's there. The responsibilities will vary from one restaurant to the next, but basically he or she is there to support whatever it is that the chef wants them to do. Not quite a cook still, not quite the chef yet.
Sous chef means under chef.
It does. Translates from French to mean under.
And you say a sous chef's primary responsibility is to taste everything before it's plated?
It's one of them, I think, for a couple of different reasons. To make sure, first of all, that chef doesn't know if something's gone wrong, and also just to assure quality control, basically.
And how often do things go wrong? How often do you have to send things back?
In an ideal world, not that frequently.
But I suspect it happens, and
I suspect it also
it can rub the person who did it the wrong way, or they could be terribly embarrassed.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, you try and avoid that. I mean, you have to be, especially as a sous chef, sort of diplomatic with how you issue your managerial, whatever feedback you have.
So diplomacy is one of the responsibilities.
Oh, absolutely. It's also one of the things that you're sort of there to learn as a sous chef, to kind of get used to those subtler elements of being a chef, I think.
Well, did you have any role models, sous chefs, that you thought you should try to be like?
Well, certainly a number. Basically, everybody that's ever been my boss, whether it's a sous chef or a chef, has in some way informed the way that I kind of carry myself into the role of a sous chef or a chef or chef de cuisine or whatever. The number one, I'd say, and mainly this is just because I'm about to work with him, is this guy Brian Young, who I'm working on opening a restaurant with this summer. And he was one of the sort of first executive chefs that really guided me into the position of management.
Well, you mentioned chef de cuisine. There are so many different titles, chef de cuisine, executive chef. Are they all pretty much the same thing?
No, certainly not. I mean, a chef de cuisine is a little bit less common, because mainly in order to have a chef de cuisine, usually the chef has to have either other restaurants or other obligations within a larger company, where he has a person sort of really be the end of the line for that particular outlet. So you don't see those as frequently in a smaller restaurant. You wouldn't have a chef de cuisine necessarily.
But the chef de cuisine is kind of the stand-in for the person whose name is on the door.
Right, right. And that would be the person who is above, under whom the sous chef is in that given restaurant.
What was it about Brian Young that was so influential?
Well, I think, to be honest, I mean, he has a lot of great experience. He was at Le Bernardin for a while. He worked at the Quilted Giraffe with a lot of these guys that we were just talking about here on the show. But also from him, I learned that you can be a very complete and sort of intellectually agile person outside just the world of cooking. That it's cool within a kitchen to know as much about as many different things as you possibly can.
So not from him, just about cooking.
Yeah, not just about cooking, and loads about cooking as well, but also how other things inform the way that you cook.
And I've noticed that. Some of the chefs who actually started as apprentices right off the farm when they were 15 or 16, whatever, have become interested in cultural matters, other things. They become autodidacts.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like cooking, professional cooking in general, is such a multifaceted thing. You know, there's anthropology, there's history, there's science, there's art, there's math sometimes, and I think it benefits any chef who's worth his salt to know as much about any of these different disciplines as possible.
My guest is Michael Gibney, who's written a book called Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line. It is published by Ballantine Books. This is WNYC. WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've written the book in second person. Why not first?
The immediate answer to that is I didn't want it to be a book about me. Not that there's anything wrong with writing a personal memoir. I just felt that it was more important for me that the kitchen and that its inhabitants were the stars of the show here.
Well, your narrator, I assume it is you, also works the fish station for a large portion of the dinner service. Fish is one of the hardest things to cook, isn't it?
I'd say so. I personally believe so, and I think a lot of people agree, mainly because it's very delicate. It's very easy to, as most people who've tried to cook it at home or in a kitchen will attest, it's easy to mess up. So it's an opportunity to showcase your skill, I think.
To overcook or undercook.
To overcook, to undercook, to, if you put it in the pan before the pan is the appropriate temperature, it may stick, it may crumble or fall apart. You just have to have a lot of finesse. So it's a showcase, really, for your abilities, I think.
Well, since so many sous chefs aspire to become head chefs, is there any rivalry or competition between the sous chef and the head chef?
Well, I don't know that there's necessarily rivalry, but I think it's not uncommon for there to be, depending on how old the sous chef is or how long he or she has been cooking, there can be some sort of resentment. You know, I want my own family that I'm you know, mom or dad of, that I'm a show that I'm running.
And I spoke to a very well-known chef about somebody who had worked for him, and he said he was always coming to me with these cockamamie ideas, and I always had to – some of them were interesting, but they really didn't fit in with our restaurant. Well, that guy has gone on to open his own restaurant and become one of the most celebrated chefs in New York.
Okay.
No names mentioned.
It's in New York. I was going to hazard
a guess. Well, in Brooklyn, anyway.
I was going to hazard a guess. Well, I think that you've hit it right there. Any creative person has sort of a vision of how they want things, and it's difficult when you are a sous chef, you're contributing to some of the creativity on the menu, to not want to take it in your own direction.
What are some of the typical problems that could arise in a kitchen on a busy night? I'm assuming cuts and burns are common.
Well, ideally they're not common at all. I mean, only sort of amateurs cut and burn themselves. We like to believe in a sort of high end kitchen. But they do happen, and certainly spills and little, you know, minor things of that sort. But also it's when someone overcooks something, or if something gets sent back from the dining room, that really kind of interrupts the flow of service.
Because you're trying to get everybody at the table their meal at the same time.
Absolutely.
And one of the things has been overcooked, or something else, or it burned, or something else happened. And now you have to hold back the whole table?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And not only do you hold back the whole table, but more often than not, you'll have to refire everything from that table, because if you made this beautiful lobster and fennel salad that looked very lovely at the time, 10 minutes from now, when that steak is ready to go with it, it's going to be limp and fallen down.
So you just throw away that other food?
Yeah. So that's what it ends up being, kind of a pretty big problem. But you'd rather throw something away than allow something inferior to arrive at the table, I think.
Well, what happens when food's sent back by a guest? I imagine that causes a big problem in the kitchen as well.
Yeah, well, the thing is that service, we call it sort of a dance. When it's going well, when it's choreographed well, it's very fluid. When something like a refire comes back, it interrupts that choreography and takes what could be a successful service and turns it into a real hazard, mainly just because you have to stop what you're doing and go back to doing something that's unrelated.
And doesn't it exacerbate the natural tension between the wait staff and the kitchen staff?
It sure does. But at the same point in time, you know, there is this fissure between the front and the back of the house, and cooks and service staff have a tendency to get upset when something gets sent back. But you know, it's very important that we always, all of us, remember that the diner does come first. So whatever is necessary to make their experience good, we all play for the same team, front and back, and we're there for them.
But there sometimes can be problems. I've had people who told me, we in the kitchen have to show up very early to prepare for everything. When the service is over, we're still there putting things away and cleaning up. The waiters show up 10 seconds before the restaurant opens, and then leave 10 seconds after it closes, and they get the tip.
I'll be the first person to complain about that, just like everybody else in the kitchen. But like most of the other people in the kitchen, you couldn't pay me enough money to go out in the dining room. So there's that. There's that sort of poetic justice of we can complain all we want, but we don't have the guts to do what they do either. So
in your book, there's a large focus on the specials of the day. Were these dishes that you'd created before, or did you have to invent them for the book?
Some of them are from before. I mean, it's I think it's fun to invent dishes. So I did have a little bit of fun trying to figure out, based on seasonality, the book takes place in December. So based on seasonality, what would fit there, and borrowing from some things that I've done before so that I didn't have to do too much work in trying to describe how to execute them. So I would say that they're basically my dishes, mostly from the past.
Now, you said that you wouldn't want to go out to the front of the room. You wouldn't want to be a waiter. Is that just simply a matter of personality, or because you get all your pleasure from cooking, or is something else going on?
I think there are a couple of things. One is I personally would have sort of a short fuse with I don't know that I have socially what it takes to be really nice to someone who doesn't see eye to eye with how I feel the food should be made. But more importantly, I think there's something that I personally and most cooks and chefs appreciate about being behind the scenes and the sort of anonymity of doing the work for the guests.
Although now there's the rise of the celebrity chef, especially with the focus on what goes on in kitchens on television. And I'm assuming that it's drawing a lot of people to the food industry who might not have been attracted to it before.
Well, I think that's great about the media. You know, there has been this sort of tidal wave of media surrounding food service in general the past at least decade, if not more. When I was a kid, I was watching cooking shows. And I think it's only for good that light is shed on the industry, because it's a beautiful industry, I think.
What happens when you're asked to make something that you think is really a lousy dish? Do you just simply bite your tongue and go ahead and do it because that's what the chef told you to do?
Oh, well, if the chef asked me to do it, then yeah, it's the onus is on me to figure out what about this particular dish the chef is envisioning, what the value of it is, and maybe it's just something I don't understand. Accepting the idea that I may not know everything and I may be wrong or may not see clearly, it, for me, is an important way to deal with that I don't like this particular dish sensation.
In this book, The Kitchen is Dominated by Men. We are seeing more women getting into the business, but should I assume that most upscale restaurants have mostly males in the kitchen?
Well, no. I don't think that would be the right assumption to make. Some of the most talented, certainly some of the absolute most talented people I know are female chefs. It's just been the case for this particular book. Looking back on my career, the characters that most exemplify each station happen to be men in my position, but I know some really extremely talented ladies. It's not strange at all to see even a 50-50 balance sometimes.
And you're not naming names. You're not telling us the restaurant. You've changed the names of the people in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect some of them will look at the book and say, oh, he wrote that about me. And,
yeah.
I didn't know he didn't like me.
Well, I thought I painted them all up in a pretty favorable light. Anybody who's not painted in a favorable light, I don't think will ever even see the book, so it doesn't really matter. But I did try to show the sort of the finesse and the work ethic that everybody contributes to the team, I think. So,
well, not one person does everything, right? It's kind of a collaborative effort.
That's the name of the game.
Very different than writing a book.
Yes, it's been a real struggle, I got to tell you. I've frequently missed the kitchen and sitting down trying to write this book for a number of reasons. The whole team thing being chief among them, I think.
And you will be going back, you said.
Absolutely. I'm already working on a place right now. I've been signed on to it since I was writing this book. I wrote this book in graduate school, and while I was there, I was still sort of consulting, and I couldn't stay away from it. I think if you have a certain metabolism, it's difficult ever to stray too long from the kitchen. It feels like home.
One more thing about women. They tend to be the people who make the desserts. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I mean, certainly the female cooks that I know work all sorts of different stations. I don't know what, you know, that's a question I think for perhaps an anthropological psychologist. I don't know why historically women gravitate towards sweet things. Maybe it's because they're nicer than men, although I met some mean ladies in the kitchen as well. But to that point, I will say that some of the most talented pastry chefs I know are men. So I do think, you know, especially moving into the future, that we're going to see a lot that this sort of the issue of sex in the kitchen will continue to sort of thin out as more people have the courage to enter different parts of it.
Well, you've worked in some of the best restaurants out there.
Well, I've worked in some good restaurants, and I've worked with a lot of really talented people from...
But you got a degree from... You studied painting at Pratt?
I did.
Does that apply at all to the way you plate something?
Yeah, well, certainly the way you plate something, but also I think it's important to note that it informs the way that I think about coming up with a dish, the actual creative process. You know, it's not just making a painting on a plate. It's also the creative way that you approach... The act of making something or communicating something.
Well, isn't there a problem on the one hand if you do stuff really well, but it's like what everybody else does, ho-hum. On the other hand, if you get too creative, sometimes you can be kind of silly. And I've seen a fair number of dishes that are, I wondered, why would the chef have put this combination together other than to be unlike other people?
I totally agree, and that's a difficult sort of tightrope to walk, and that has to do with remembering who you're feeding and that you're there to feed somebody. So there's no point if you're doing it just to impress yourself or the other cooks around you. There's not really much point in it. But to the point of sort of making something creative, I think it's the same way. If you make a painting that nobody can see or some really abstract piece of art that nobody gets, you're not doing the job of communicating something to people.
Do you think that an abstract artist is better at plating than somebody who a figurative artist?
I think anybody who has a good idea of composition and can be inventive and sort of has an imagination, it can be a great plater.
Michael Gibney's book, Sous Chef, 24 Hours on the Line, is published by Ballantine Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real treat.